So we're coming this week to Genesis 29 through 31. I call it Jacob in the house of Laban. And last week I said this is Jacob going from red, Esau, to white, Laban. And when we have Jacob in the house of Laban, we ask a couple of questions to get us started. And I asked you to read this last week and answer these questions or think about these questions. You can look at these two lives, these two women that Jacob is now entangled with, Rachel and Leah. How are they similar to Rebekah? What are their motives for having children? As you read through this, you can see the problem that is created in this household. So let's attack those questions and someone begin and kick us off with what they have found. So who do you think of these women is most like Rebekah?
Rachel
is, isn't she? Yeah, you look at Rachel and all the characteristics of Rachel as you look at Jacob and the relationship. You have this true love that Jacob had for Rachel. And you had the true love between Isaac and Rebekah. Even though they're at odds about their kids, there's no conflict between them, really. And in fact, the only conflict is that there's this kind of underlying, we've got to compromise here on these kids at some point. But and we covered that last week. The problem in this whole relationship, Rebekah for Isaac was whose choice? God's choice. God chose Rebekah for Isaac. So who is in control of these families ultimately? So what is God's choice? Who is God's choice for Jacob? Okay, some of you say Rachel, and I've heard Leah. So those of you that say Leah are minds that are more analytical, that you could take the evidence and say that Leah is the chosen wife. Those of you who are a little more romantic, fall a little more romantic side, and I identify with this. He's in love with her. That's what you only should marry the person you love, not the person your father decides that you should have. Now, who's the ultimate father here? God is the ultimate father. Laban, in this family, is the father, is the God-ordained authority. He has the right to choose who his children marry. Jacob really is wrestling with everybody around him. In fact, from his very birth, he had the idea that as he comes out of the womb, he's grabbed the heel of his brother. And, of course, the name them came to mean in Hebrew to be a cheater, to be a chiseler, to be one who by cunning would cheat you out of something, and you would even realize you've been cheated. And Jacob is given the promise. God said before they were born that the older will serve the younger. He had this promise from before he was born that he was going to be the one who would be the firstborn. And yet he wrestles with God over this by cheating his brother, then cheating his father and coercing with his mother. But he meets Laban and this struggle begins with Laban. And he's not just struggling with Laban. And he's not just struggling with Rachel and Leah. He is struggling with God. He is struggling against God's will for him. He cannot see it. Everything he does, every decision he makes, has a deceptive motive. And with Laban, he meets his match. So we're going to go back to last week because we have to start his journey. Remember, why does he go to Laban? Why does he go to the land of Haran? He can't just pack up and leave because Isaac's his father. Again, who's the ruling authority in the family? The father. He can't just pack up and leave. So how is it that he's allowed to leave with Isaac's blessing?
Well, grieve Rebekah if he takes one of those women to
wife. Yeah, well, that's what she says to Isaac, isn't it? That's what she said. There you go. Is Rebekah being straightforward? No, she's being deceptive. She knows which button to push on Isaac. Because Esau's married two Canaanite women, hasn't he? And it's just driving them nuts. They're driving them crazy. So Rebekah, after she knows that Esau wants to kill Jacob, and he's going to kill him. I mean, he's going to take revenge. She goes to Isaac and she says, you know, do you want another Canaanite woman in the house? What if Jacob marries a Canaanite woman? And Isaac goes, ooh, his lights come on. And he goes, ooh, that's the button she pushes. And she says, why don't we send him away to my family's house? Isaac says, that's a good idea, Rebecca. So he goes away. But she has to give up her son, the son that she loves. You know, the chances are, she knows this. She's never going to see him again. Does she? No. Again, that had to be a heart-wrenching experience. But why does she do it? Save his life. There. That's what I wanted you to see. Now, so he leaves. He goes to Beersheba. He has a dream. And this place isn't called Bethel when he arrives there. It's got a different name. It's called Luz. But because God appears to him there, and what's his dream? Stairway to heaven. And so he names the place Beit El, which is the house of the Lord, house of God. Then he goes on from there, and that's what we want to get to. So he goes on his journey from there. He's got this promise, and the promise God made to him is you will have land, seed, and blessing, the same promises he gave to Abraham, because these promises are now being passed down from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. And Jacob, here's the vow he makes to God. I love the way he makes this vow. You've all made vows like this. I know you have. If God... you will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house. If you do all that, God, then the Lord, Yahweh, will be my God, and this stone I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. That's Beit El, house of God. Of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. I'll tithe everything back to you if you bless me. Boy, I tell you, God, if you will do this, then I will do that. I don't know how many times, I can't tell you how many times I have prayed this prayer. God, if you get me out of this without the consequences I'm afraid of, I promise, and then fill in the blank. It's called foxhole religion. The guys in the foxholes in World War II, God, if you get me out of this foxhole and get me home alive, I'll go to church every Sunday. It's foxhole religion. Sometimes they did it, sometimes they didn't. But that's a very conditional promise. And this is the kind of the vow he's making. It's very conditional. Now remember, why is he on this journey? His life's at stake. He's running from Esau. He's fearing for his life. And his mother is fearing for his life. And he meets God on the way. And God makes these promises. And God makes very strong promises. And you know what? By this vow that he makes, he's saying, I know you told me this, but I'm not sure I'm going to be back this way. But if I come back, then, okay, then I'll honor you. And he is so not willing to really give himself over to this God who's going to take care of him. And so he leaves Bethel, and he makes this journey. And it's a long journey. This is a long way. And he can't be by himself when he does this, because no one could travel like this by himself. He has to have an entourage. He has to have men with him, camels. He has to have food. It reads as if he's all by himself, but you have to put yourself in the context of this time. You cannot make this journey by yourself. A, it's too dangerous. It's too far. You need too many supplies. You need men to carry. You need servants. He says he goes to Haran, and this whole region is Haran. It's the region between these two rivers. Nahor is at the bottom of two rivers. And so this is really where he ends up. He ends up at Laban's house. And we know from the last time, Laban was living with Bethuel, which was the son of Nahor. And they were living in this town named after that father. So here we have this journey. That he comes to the end of his journey. He comes to the place where they water the sheep. And it says, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, now this is Laban's, Rebekah's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and he rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. But then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep loudly, because the first person he meets, well, this isn't the first girl he meets, he's met some other shepherd, but the first girl he meets is the daughter of Laban, and he knows the story of Laban and Rebekah, and Rebekah coming to Isaac. He knows who this is. There's no question he knows who this is. And he told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she knows who that is. So she ran and tells her father that this Jacob is here from the house of Abraham, the son of Isaac. Oh, wow, this lights up Laban. Because remember, what was Laban's reaction to Rebecca coming into the house after talking to Eliezer, when Eliezer put the ring in her nose, which was a sign of engagement, and two heavy bracelets on her wrist, pure gold. She goes into the house, tells her family what has just happened, and Laban runs out and says, "Oh, my brother, you know, I'm so happy to meet you." Because it says he had seen the gold on her wrist and the gold in her nose. So this is the kind of guy he is. So he's thinking, man, the family with all the bucks is back. Jacob kissed Rachel. You don't, in our culture, we misunderstand that because a kiss means something different to us than it did to them. This kiss is simply a kiss of greeting, not so much a kiss of romance. And he begins to weep over this. And this is the weeping of joy, not the weeping of tragedy. This is a greeting for a relative. And as soon as Laban heard the news, his sister's son, he hurried out to meet him. He embraced him and he kissed him. See, again, that's that idea of the kiss. And brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him all these things. What did Jacob tell him? He'd essentially told him everything that had happened up to this point in his life. Why am I here? I'm here because of what happened down there. My brother's after me. He's going to kill me. He tells him the whole story. And so he stays there a month. Well, after a month, he's a guest for a month. After a month, Laban starts to go, you know, if you're going to hang around, just eat my food, and he said, you know, you should do some work. And he said, I'll pay you wages. Laban said, oh, here's what Laban, when he meets him, I almost missed this point. When he meets him, he says, oh, he hears the story. And he says, oh, you most certainly, that's the idea here, you're most certainly my flesh and blood. I understand you, you're just like me. Oh. They have met, these two guys meet, and Laban understands Jacob's heart. And like P.T. Barnum, he understood the premise that you cannot cheat an honest man. And he knows that he does not have an honest man here. So he goes, this is just a great find. Because as devious as he has been in the story he's told me, Laban's got one up on him. So that's what I say. I call this, we really are alike. Jacob meets his match. Now, as the story progresses, Jacob was in love with Rachel, and he said, I'll work for you for 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Now, look at this. This is where the deception starts. I know some of you brought this up already, but this is exactly where the deception starts. Did Laban say, oh, I'm sorry, Jacob, but you know, here's the culture that we live in, and this is the rule of my house. I'm taking the rule of the culture and making this the rule of my house, and I'm the authority here. I'm the father. I cannot marry off the younger daughter before the older daughter. I'm sorry, Jacob, I can't do that. An honest man would have said that. But Laban ain't going to say that, because Jacob makes the offer. I'll work for you 7 years. And that Laban's not going to say, well, you got to marry the other one because I can't marry off the younger first, so I can't take your deal. He hears, I'm going to work for you 7 years. He goes, 7 years of free labor. And I don't have to give him. It's not the rule of my house, but I'm not going to tell him that. That's where the deception starts. This is where Jacob meets his match. Story goes on. They go through the 7 years. He gets Leah. They go through the wedding night. In a wedding in the Middle East, there's a lot of wine to be drank. So by the time it gets to the time when the bride is going to go into the husband, they've all imbibed quite a bit. But there's no details here as how he got confused between Leah and Rachel. There's no details. That's left up to your imagination. When he turns the light on in the morning and he sees it's Leah, he runs out and he says, why have you done this to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Why did you? And Laban says, well, you know, it's not our custom to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Now he tells him. Jacob is now in a position where he's married. Now, I make this argument that what is God's rule for marriage? 1-to-1. Genesis chapter 2. Man and woman will leave the family and cleave to one another. And two become one. Not three become one. Not four become one. There is no more than one and one become one. So when you stop right here, if the story would stop right here, who's Jacob married to? Leah. Yeah. Okay? Now, in their culture, they allowed men to take more than one wife. In fact, they allowed men to take the maidens of their wives and have children with them. Their culture allowed that. And you know, God kind of allowed things to happen. You know what? The people still suffered the consequences. Because it always led to problems. Look at what, when Abraham took Hagar and had Ishmael, did that bring peace to the house? Did that bring blessing and joy and happiness? No. Because the consequence of that was trouble. Yeah. Jealousy and problems. You take our culture today, and it's changing dramatically. And many of us just can't get used to it. And we shouldn't get used to it. Because we should hold to this notion of one man, one woman, and the man cleaves to the woman, and the two become one. We should hold that and hold that dearly and not try to make an excuse here. Because if we can make an excuse here, then we can excuse our culture today. And we cannot change the culture. Paul said we live in an evil day. And what's our job? To hold forth the word of life. They didn't have it any better then than we have now. And Jacob, blessed by God, he's been chosen by God to be the one who's in the line of the Messiah, and look at the way he's acting. But he's going to suffer consequences. So, Laban finally tells the truth and makes another deal. Finish with this daughter's bridal week. Spend the week you're supposed to spend with her for the week. Then we will give you the younger one, but here's the deal. Another 7 years. Now, a wise man would reject that. I don't like this. This is what I intended, but this is God's will. This must be God's will for my life because, A, it came through the father of the house. B, we don't always necessarily like everything God does, but this must be what his will is. This is life hitting me, and I have to accept life on life's terms. I cannot say, well, I don't like this, therefore I got to find another way. Now, Laban, he wants another 7 years' work. You can see his motive. But a wise man would have rejected that offer and says, no, this is where God has me. I'm staying here. But Jacob is not a wise man. Is he? No. He's not a wise man. So Jacob goes with Rachel. He lays with Rachel also. He loved Rachel more than Leah, and he worked for Laban another 7 years. So now he's got two wives in the house. This is where it gets interesting. Here's Laban's bargain. Leah, 7 years of labor, but who suggested the 7 years of labor for Leah? Jacob. Rachel, 7 years of labor, but who came up with that plan? Laban. So here you have an agreement with these two guys, both men trying to deceive the other, and here's where they end up. He ends up with a house with two women who really, really don't like each other. But you have to go to another level and say, how does he end up in this way? They had to all conspire together to trick him. Because Rachel maybe didn't like it, but she's going to obey her father when her father says, you're not going in there. Leah's going in there. You're not going in there. So Leah has to be part of the deception, Rachel has to be part of the deception, and Laban is part of the deception. And you think, how can anything come out of this? But see, you have God working in the background here, allowing people to make these unwise, disastrous decisions, allowing it, not coming down and saying, no, not appearing like he did at Bethel, saying, I'm going to bless you, not coming and saying, look, Jacob, don't do this. He doesn't do that. He allows these things to occur. He allows them to suffer the pain of the consequences. And he allows them to work through this until finally he gets them to the point where they're going to reach out to him. Jacob is struggling not just with Laban and with Leah and Rachel, but with God himself. Because God's will is at work all the time. This section is divided very nicely. From 29 through 30, 26, it's Jacob in the home. And let me break the story down for you in this whole narrative. This whole section focuses on Jacob's home life. The next section focuses on his life in the field, or his work life. So you say home life and work life. They're both deception. He had a better time in the field than he did at home. But Bud pointed out at the beginning, he got cheated 10 times during this course of his work life. But it's kind of broken up into these two segments. He wants to focus down on what is it like in this relationship between these two women. And it's not good. And what you have here is you really have the Lord sees what's going on. I love this. Because this goes back and rings a bell from previously. Who is it that says the Lord sees and I know he sees? And Hagar. Because she says that she names the well, remember? She names that well Be'er Lahai Roi, the well of the living one who sees me. The Lord sees, so that becomes this whole theme here. When the Lord saw, because the Lord sees, that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb. But Rachel was barren. Who caused Rachel to be barren? If it says the Lord saw that Leah was not loved and Rachel was barren, who caused Rachel to be barren? The Lord saw Leah was not loved and he opened her womb. Balance the equation. And the Lord saw that Rachel was loved, and he made her barren. I mean, if the Lord's in control of one woman, why is he not in control of the other? That's what I want you to see. So then, the Lord remembers. And this is much, much later. So you have to tie these two things together. The Lord sees Leah that she's not loved. And then, but the Lord remembered Rachel and listened to her and opened her womb. So she's no longer barren, and she now has a child. The Lord may hold someone off in pain and suffering for many, many years. But, you know, when he remembers, that means he acts. It means he's acting in such a way as to bless them because they have waited upon him long enough. These are the children. Leah names her first son Reuben because she says, this is the son from the Lord who sees. Ru means to see. Ben is the name, is just simply the word for son. So this is the son of the God who sees. Her next son is Simeon or Shamaon, and that is the Lord hears. Shama. Remember Hagar's son?
Yes.
Ishmael, the Lord hears. This is Shamaon, the Lord hears. And then Levi, this is her third child. Now she goes, oh, I've had three kids. Rachel's had none. And now maybe Jacob will join himself to me. Maybe now we can become one. He will join to me. Because Lev means to join or to knot together. And E is the Hebrew me. So he joins me. So she's hoping that that's what happened. Then she has another one right away, Judah. What's Judah mean? Judah is praise the Lord. Our first four names in Leah's list. Who do three of them focus upon? God himself. And it says that Leah, it says she has weak eyes, right? But you know, the word eye in Hebrew is often used as an idiom for describing the way a person is. Like someone who has evil eyes. That means one who displeases you.
Oh, okay.
You gave me the evil eye. It causes displeasure. Okay. There's also the good-eyed person, someone who pleases you. It's kind eyes.
Have you seen anybody's eyes?
Tender eyes. That's someone who's compassionate. Now, when it calls someone who has weak eyes, or soft eyes, is another word for weak. Soft eyes, this is someone who is tender and gentle. And so you have all these Hebrew idioms for eyes. You have the wandering eye.
Men do that.
So Leah has all these children. Two through a maid, Gad, she calls him fortunate because God blesses me. But Gad is also the name of a false god. Because here what you have in this house, you have the worship of idols, superstition, and idolatry going on in a household that also believes in the living true God. So you got this blend of beliefs going on. And that happens in Christian homes in our culture. Superstition kind of creeps in. She names the next one Asher, meaning happy. Issachar, that goes back to the Lord again. The Lord rewards. And Zebulun goes back to he honors me, meaning Jacob honors me because he's given me all these children. And then the last one is a girl.
Yay.
Dinah. Binah. From the word justice. Now, Rachel is jealous, so she starts having kids, but she has her first one through Bilhah, doesn't have it herself, names him Dan. He judges. Again, referring to God, saying, he's judge now between me and Rachel. So this is a little bit vindictive. Say, this is my vindication. God judges Dan. And that's tied to the name Dinah. The two are related, justice and judge. Bilhah, Naphtali, my struggle. My struggle with Jacob and my struggle with my sister. And this is Jacob's struggle as well. She finally has a son, Joseph. You know when she has this son? After all these kids have been born, she finally has Joseph. And Joseph means do again. Yosef, or it's an expression, the Lord do this again. Please do this again. Now that's the last kid she has until they're on their way home. She doesn't have another one until Canaan near Bethlehem. She calls him Benoni because she's dying as she's having him. So she names him Benoni, the son of sorrow. And as soon as she dies, Jacob takes that baby and says, I will not call him Benoni, I'm calling him Benjamin, the son of my right hand, or son of the right, which is a reflection of the hand. So that's how he gets his name, Benjamin. Benjamin. Jacob in the field now, that's Jacob in the house, all that conflict. And you should read through that to get all the nuance there. But this is Jacob in the field. This is where the Lord starts to bless him. Though he's superstitious, because really, this cutting the stripes in the in the branches. This is like the water wand, you know. This is really no more than that. This is simply superstitious practice. It's not based in science. There's no scientific evidence that striping wood actually brings forth striped sheep or striped goats.
And the mandrakes, too.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the mandrakes in the home, yeah. The mandrakes are another superstition. If I eat mandrakes, it'll make me fertile. Laban says, if I found favor in your own eyes, please stay. Because I've learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. So he says, I've gotten rich here because of you. So I've learned by divination. And this divination is this idea of getting knowledge from beyond the realm of the spiritual world to help me make decisions in my life. Reading a horoscope. People do that every day. So Jacob makes another bargain. Now, he hasn't done so well in the past, but he says, okay, I'll make a bargain with you. And Laban says, what shall I give you? And Jacob says, don't give me anything, but just do this one thing. I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Here's what you got to do. You let me go through all your flocks today and remove every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, and every spotted or speckled goat. That'll be my wages. I'll just take the speckled ones or the spotted ones. Everybody knows that the white sheep are the most valuable sheep. Because when you shear a sheep and you mix black wool with white wool, you can't dye the black wool. You want either sheep of all one color or you want them pure white. And pure white's the best. You can dye it any color. So the very best sheep are all white. Jacob is trying to manipulate Laban. He's saying, I've got a way to keep all the sheep speckled and spotted. I've got a way to do this. If he just gives me his white sheep, I'll turn him into speckled and spotted sheep. Says to him, he says, if you come to my flock and find any white sheep, you'll know I've cheated you. I'll take everything but the white sheep. You take all the white sheep. They're the best ones. I'll just keep the second hands. Well, what Laban does, this is how crooked these guys are. He tells his shepherds, he says, quick, get out there, gather up all the spotted and speckled sheep and get them out of here. And it says they take them 3 days' journey away. So now what's Jacob left with is all white. He doesn't have anything to pick from. And these are Laban's sheep. So these are the ones he's tending. I read through this and I'm always baffled by it. I'm a little bit like this guy here. God sovereignly overruled in this contract, and he blesses Jacob in spite of Laban's deceit. And in spite of Jacob's devious plan, God's going to bless him. This is where you start to see the Lord break through. He comes to the point where he's manipulating the flock. And he's doing it superstitiously. Whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches and the troughs in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak animals, he would not place them there. This is not scientific. Please don't go and get some sheep and try to do this yourself. The weak animals went to Laban. And these are the crybaby sheep. These are the weak ones. And the strong ones went to Jacob. He thinks he's manipulating this on his own power, through his own intelligence, and through his own superstitious strength. But he's not. It's the Lord himself doing it. So once all this goes about for a time, the Lord finally comes to Jacob. He says, go back to the land of your fathers and your relatives, and I'm going to be with you. Just like he told him when he left, remember? I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be with you when you're up there. I'm going to be with you when you come back. So Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where his flocks were. And he says, I see that your father's attitude toward me is not what it was before. Well, it really is. But he realizes he's in a conflict here. He's in a problem. But the God of my father has been with me. And this is the first time in this narrative you get any recognition on Jacob's part that God is involved in his life. He says, you know that I work for your father with all my strength. Yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. He's protected me. So he's acknowledging now for the first time that God is engineering the events, that God's in control. And he's really crediting God for his very survival at this point. He's never done this before. And so this is a real turning point for him. And he really ultimately says that my success is because of God. It's because of God's grace. Read, if you're in 31, read where he says here. I'm just going to read this real quick. It came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and I saw in a dream. I saw in a dream and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. And the angel of God came to me in the dream and said, Jacob. And I said, here I am. He said, lift up now your eyes and see all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel. I'm the God who you met back there. where you anointed the pillar, where you made a vow to me, now arise and leave this land and return to the land of your birth. So now he believes in God. This is the first time he's merged as a man of faith, and it's the first time he's really risen up to the leadership of the family. Because if you, when you read Jacob in the house, he kind of gets pushed around, doesn't he? It kind of reminds me of the way he lived under Rebekah. And now he's taken a stand, and it gets better. Because he leaves, and he leaves with everything, all the sheep, all the things that are rightfully his, and he takes off, and he's on his way back. From Haran, he gets to Gilead. Because 3 days after he leaves, Laban finds out, hey, they're all gone. He's taken my daughters, he's taken my grandkids, and he goes after them. 7 days later, he catches up with them. So 10 days go by. Now, they have a confrontation that you wouldn't believe. But look at the first thing that Laban says. What have you done? You've deceived me. I think that's funny. Especially when you compare what he's saying here to what he says the first time he meets him. Oh, I can tell that you're my flesh and blood. You really are. We understand each other. Now he's on the receiving end of what he's done. He says, what you've done, you've stolen the gods of my house. And Jacob says, if anyone who has your gods, these idols that you have in your house, these superstitious idols, he shall not live. If I find out that he's in my camp and he stole them, he'll die. In the presence of our relatives, see for yourself whether there's any of yours here with me, and if so, take it. Take your gods and get out of here. Now, Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen the gods, and he makes this vow. And you know, when you tie that to what happens to Rachel next, there's a link. Because the next thing that happens is that she dies before she ever gets back to the homeland near Kadesh Barnea. Jacob was angry, goes on in the narrative as they argue back and forth, took Laban to task. This is the first time he stood up to him as a man, saying, you're not going to do this. What is my crime? What sin have I committed that you hunt me down? So these men are enemies. So what do? They built a pillar of rocks. And they called this pillar Mizpah, watchtower. May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. And this is not a blessing between friends, but it's a warning between enemies that I don't trust you, you don't trust me. This pillar stands as a testimony to that. Do not cross this line. Because if you do, that means war. And of course, the other is also too. Don't come north of Gilead coming after me. Because we are enemies. These men do not part friends, but they do part. And I will not go past this heap to harm you. You will not go past to harm me. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, and their father is Terah, because the God of Abraham is also the God of Terah. Terah is Abraham's father. This is the God of the family. Judge between us. Now the problem is, this looks like he's talking about the same God. And this God of Abraham is the one true living God. This God of Nahor is probably not. He's probably the gods of the God of the idols that are in the saddlebag. Because it says here, may they judge between us. The Hebrew verb there is a plural. May they judge. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor. You can read that and say, oh, it's the same one. It's really not. They judge between us. So Jacob took an oath in the name of the fear of his father Isaac. Meaning, he took the oath in the name of the God that Isaac feared, which is this God. It's an interpretive problem, but I interpret it to meaning he's talking about two different people because they judge between us. So Laban goes back home. Jacob heads on down south. Jacob's got a terrible problem up ahead. 32-33 is we're going to be next week. Jacob's got to meet Esau. Here are the questions for next time. If you're going to read this, what's the very heart of the narrative? As you go from 32-33, look for that. What's the very heart of the narrative? Ask yourself, why does it represent Jacob's character so explicitly? And examine the changes both in Jacob and Esau and say, what is most surprising about this narrative between these two brothers? What's most surprising?